Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from Petitioner Diaz versus Westfall.
May it please the court, Mr. Pablo Villarreal, will make an argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Carlos Villarreal. I'm here for Dr. Diaz. Dr. Diaz received a summary judgment from the trial court. Part of that summary judgment was affirmed. Part regarding the minor, Eric Westfall, was reversed. And we're here on my petition seeking to have that part of the reverse summary judgment heard. And the Court of Appeals opinion reversed on that basis and the summary judgment affirmed. First, I think it's important to just run through the facts a little bit. Dr. Diaz last treated Michael Westfall in August of 1984. In September of 1984, Michael Westfall went on vacation in North Carolina. He experienced urinary tract bleeding and went to the emergency room there. A physician there told him that he had been on Cytoxan too long. Cytoxan was a drug that was being given to him, prescribed to him, since 1977 by Dr. Diaz and earlier by other doctors. The physician in North Carolina told him not to take the Cytoxan. He had been on it too long, and he stopped taking it. He continued his vacation to Colorado, where he was hospitalized for 2 weeks with the same urinary tract bleeding and inability to urinate. He came back to Texas and was immediately sent to Citizens Hospital in Victoria for another emergency hospitalization and with the same symptoms. It is relevant to note that when he returned to Texas, he did not go back to Dr. Diaz. His wife explained on deposition that the reason they didn't go back to Dr. Diaz is that they felt that he had committed an error in professional judgment in treating Michael and leaving him on the Cytoxan for the period of time that he had. Now, in March of 1991, Michael Westfall was diagnosed with cancer. He died in April of 1992, and the suit was filed in May of 1993.
Did you conclusively establish that the blood in the urine was related to bladder cancer, or does it make any difference?
It was not just blood in the urine, Your Honor. It was what was established in the deposition that he had continual problems with his bladder from 1984 through his to his death in 1992, and repeated hospitalizations related thereto. They were going to reconstruct his bladder, and that's when they detected the cancer. Now, with regard to the relationship between the cancer and the initial injuries, the initial hospitalizations, I think the connection was established by the plaintiffs themselves, where they, in their petition, alleged that the cancer was caused by Cytoxan, and in deposition, explained that the injuries, the hospitalizations that were experienced in 1984, were from the same prescription of Cytoxan. In other words, the same wrong, the same incident, the same occurrence.
So they had expert testimony connecting the initial symptoms of blood in the urine to Cytoxan?
No, Your Honor, there's no expert testimony to that effect.
So you're relying on their pleading?
I'm relying on their admissions that they connect the two. They connect the Cytoxan prescription with, and we accept those for purposes of the summary judgment. We accept the pleading saying that the Cytoxan caused the cancer.
There is no independent proof. You're relying on an admission in
that's
their
correct.
Petition.
The Court of Appeals said that I should have, by expert testimony, established that the Cytoxan caused the cancer, which is diametrically opposed to my client's position in the case. It would be ridiculous for me to go into court and say and establish through expert testimony that the Cytoxan caused the cancer.
The plaintiff had no expert testimony at all?
No, Your Honor. All the testimony we have here is really from Mrs. Westfall herself. It's either her deposition testimony or her affidavit testimony. They offered an affidavit to controvert our proof. We offered her deposition testimony.
If we determine that the limitations period begins running from the date that it was learned that the drug might cause cancer, would you lose?
Yes, Your Honor, there are a lot of good reasons why I think you shouldn't.
Well, I agree with that.
but yeah, I think if it was filed less than 2 years and 75 days after the diagnosis of cancer, after she says it was diagnosed. And so, yes, if the date of diagnosis is used, then we've got a problem.
If Mr. Westfall believed that the blood, the symptoms, the blood in the urine were related to Cytoxan, does that necessarily put him on notice that it may cause cancer?
Your Honor, I think...
In other words, does the cause of action accrue for the cancer?
I think there are a multitude of cases from particularly the courts of appeals, not necessarily from this court, but if you look at the Cody case, the Cody Versailles problems, where there's an IUD implanted and she has pelvic inflammatory disease, and then 5 years later she has a hysterectomy and she tries to sue based on the hysterectomy date, they say no, it goes back to that.
Right, I agree there are a lot of cases that say even though there's some damage, you're right. Still on notice, even though the full extent of the damage is not known.
Yes.
But those are were singular claims of injury, and here I guess what I'm asking are the blood in the urine, which you say started the statute running, and the cancer, the same thing, same injury, or are they different? Should they be distinguished from one from the other?
Your Honor, the allegation is that Cytoxan overprescription caused the cancer. The allegation is that Cytoxan overprescription caused the damage, the bladder damage and urinary tract bleeding that led to several hospitalizations in 1984. Yes, I think that it accrued in 1984, and that's when they were on notice of the claim. I think that the statute of limitations inquiry that this court has established is two-stage. First, whether or not there is any wrongful death. At this intersection of wrongful death and medical malpractice, there's this two-stage analysis. First of all, under Russell versus Ingersoll Rand, I think Justice Heck's opinion very clearly states the first inquiry is whether or not the cause of action accrued. And for that, we evaluate the statute of limitations as to the decedent's cause of action and evaluate whether he would have had a cause of action immediately prior to his death. Now, the second stage of that analysis being, okay, if we get beyond that accrual statute of limitations, then has the claimant brought suit within the statute of limitations that's applicable to them. Now, in the last 14 months of this case, this court has decided two cases involving wrongful death claims in medical malpractice situations, the Baptist Hospital versus Adelaide case and the Bala versus Maxwell case. Both of those cases were decided on the second part of that two-stage inquiry. That is, in both cases, you had an accrual because at the time of death, in Baptist Hospital versus Adelaide, the two-day-old infant who died at the time of that infant's death. In the other case, the cancer, at the time of that person's death, there was a cause of action that was still available based on the appropriate trigger dates for the statute of limitations. And so this court has yet to decide a case involving wrongful death claims arising out of medical malpractice based on the first part of this analysis, as the court did in Russell versus Ingersoll Rand. And that's what I think this court, this case provides the court an opportunity to write on. That is to clarify that the first inquiry is whether or not the decedent had a cause of action at his demise.
In this case, the current Medical Malpractice Act, or the one that was in effect, let's go into the current act. If there had been treatment in 1984 and no symptoms, no blood in the urine, but cancer had developed late 80s or early 90s. When would limitations start running on that? The last time I saw Dr. Diaz would say it was 84. But there's an allegation that the course of treatment there caused a cancer which manifested itself some years later. Under the current Medical Malpractice and Medical Improvement Act, whatever it's called.
Yes, sir.
When did limitations come into run?
Your Honor, I believe that Section 10.01 states at the end of the course of treatment, in this case it was a course of treatment that we're dealing with, because he was being treated for Hodgkin's disease with the Cytoxan. So the last date of treatment would have been August of 1984. That would have triggered the beginning of the statute of limitations. It would have run by August of 1986, or 75 days thereafter.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume that you go to a doctor today and the doctor prescribes for you as a general health measure that you take 10 aspirin a day. And you do that, and you find out a year from now that you have some stomach disorder, maybe some bleeding from the stomach, and as I mentioned, you learn that a year from now. But you decide not to sue because you've heard before that taking a lot of aspirin could cause some type of stomach disorder. But then you learn 5 years after that that unbelievably taking that many aspirin can cause cancer. Would you agree that even though you had no clue when you learned that you had the stomach bleeding problem, that you may also have cancer, would you agree that you would have no cause of action for suing that doctor for prescribing you 10 aspirin a day for causing you cancer?
I think that's the way the statute reads. I think that's the way the cases out of this court would require the result.
You could not have known that, though. It never manifested itself in less than 5 years. Isn't that where our open court's decisions have
I understood Justice Abbott's question to mean that it did manifest itself, that I had bleeding.
You had bleeding?
Right.
My stomach was bleeding. But you had no indication of cancer.
Oh, okay.
I understood that there was some indication of harm occurring contemporaneously with the treatment.
And so no matter how minimal that harm is, even if it costs you $100,000 to prosecute the case and your damages are going to be a dollar and a half, if you have any manifestation, then you conclude the statute starts running and open court's doctrine would not avail you to toll the running.
Well, we can get into deciding what is legally significant injury so as to begin the triggering. But if we do that, if we put it in the context of cases that have talked about what injury would put someone on notice, this what's established is 3 weeks of hospitalization and continued bladder problems until his demise and hospitalization thereafter. That, I think, would fall within what has been characterized as legally significant injury so as to begin the statute of limitations running. The other case that I think is relevant on this issue is Justice Baker's opinion in Jennings versus Burgess. There, the negligent referral situation, the court says at the time of referral, the patient knew that she was being referred to a general practitioner instead of a specialist, and so that triggers the statute of limitations to begin running. This is before the patient has any clue that this is going to be maltreatment or any damages are going to result to her or anything else. And so if we're saying, well, what establishes a trigger, what degree of harm, if the referral in Jennings versus Burgess is sufficient, so it's a trigger at the beginning of the statute of limitations, then certainly the hospitalizations and the injury that Mr. Westfall had in 1984 are sufficient to trigger the statute of limitations from that.
Mr. Goodell, under your analysis and your argument, given the fact that Eric's wrongful death and survival action is derivative of his father, Mr. Westfall, if Mr. Westfall did not have a cause of action at the time of his death, we need to look no further and say, because his father, Mr. Westfall, did not have a cause of action, his son did not have a cause of action, and we do not need to get into the tolling, whether or not the tolling provision is applicable in this case.
Absolutely. That's my contention. The court needs to establish basically a hierarchy or the order in which this analysis, this two-stage analysis, needs to take place. And respectfully submitted that the first stage should be whether or not there's an accrual under Russell versus Ingersoll and Rand. And for that, we need to evaluate whether the decedent had a cause of action at the time of his death. And I think the court needs to openly reserve, because I can anticipate the argument, well, what if the decedent dies, and he has a cause of action, and the minor doesn't bring it until 20 years later, or 18 years later, whatever. That's not our facts here. Our facts here are we have treatment, we have damage in 1984, the statute of limitations runs in 1986, Eric Westfall is not even born until 1987 or 1988, and then there's a diagnosis of cancer and eventual death. But I think that establishing the order in which you take these inquiries would go a long way to resolving this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please report, Mr. Norman Thomas, to present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. I've been wrestling with how to open. As I've talked to you for probably 25 times the last 3 to 4 weeks, as I've been getting ready to come up here, and I'm just going to tell you why I took the case. Because you need to know what happens down in little towns, like Furio, Goliad, where people are very patriotic, conservative, like to get back up off the ground after they've been knocked down, don't like to sue people because they just think there's other things better in life to do than run into the courthouse and sue somebody. And when I visited with these people and learned the facts and got the truth from them, as she said in her deposition, Ms. Westfall, that my husband Michael, my high school sweetheart, he just wanted to get back to work. He didn't want to rush into the courthouse. He's got Hodgkin's disease. He can handle a hospitalization. But it's a different story when I'm going to die, when I'm going to leave myself.
Mr. Thomas, did you allege that toxin caused the cancer?
Yes, no question about that.
And how would you analyze this case given Russell versus Ingersoll?
And if Your Honor would please. I lose names of cases.
Russell
versus Ingersoll, is that the slightest harm case once you know there's...
No, Russell Ingersoll talks about whether or not the cause of action accrues for the individual that is harmed. And to Mr. Westfall, was the wrongful prescription of the toxin, that's what caused the harm.
Right.
And his wife admitted in deposition that they knew that injury had occurred, whether they decided to sue or not, for whatever reason. And if Ingersoll Rand stands for the proposition that the survivor's action, the cause of action, is derivative from the person that was injured, how do you get around the fact that if that is the case, Eric's cause of action did never accrue because his father didn't have a cause of action?
I do not get around that case, if that is the case. If this court, when it determines the social contracts between people and what we do when there's a breach of our social contracts, if this court has decided and is going to keep it as the law, if it has decided that no matter how minor the breach in our social contract is, that I am required then to go into court or be told that I have slept on my rights.
It's really not ours deciding this because we're operating with a statute.
I understand, Your Honor.
It has on its face no exceptions. And it's really what the people of Texas demanded by this constitutional language that we've had since 1836 about the courts being wrong. But that's not a carte blanche check to us to say, legislature says absolute 2 years,
statute of limitations plus 75 days, but we'll just extend that when people are conservative or when this or when that.
The legislature, with all due respect, Your Honor, did not say, did not use the slightest harm language. That's not in the statute. The legislature did not say, when they said wrongful death accrues upon the death, the cause of action for wrongful death accrues upon the death. That's what they said. This honorable court, as it does, using its collective wisdom, its conscience, the resources that this court has in it, its God-given and God-blessed duty, this court has decided what those words mean. And that's why we're here, because you and your fellow justices are going to decide what those words mean. And when you determine what the words mean, that's why we're here. The legislature and the people have spoken. You, in your wisdom, tell us what those words mean. And reasonable minds can differ, and they have. And sometimes when I read the opinions and I read dissents, it hurts inside, because sometimes dissents to me are too, they lose sight to me of the fact that reasonable minds, good men and women of conscience, can differ on points. I'm here to serve you and hopefully help this law rise to something higher than just argument over words. And I believe the Justice's Gonzales question, how do I get around the Ingersoll case? If the case is derivative, which this court has spoken well, that it's derivative, that this court has said, and I'm paraphrasing in effect, that rights of widows, children, others, can be affected by the fact that, in this case, the father did not sue. And that's just life. That's fine. That's the law. If it's derivative, then I'd ask the court to look at this, its ruling and its decision on slight harm. That, and this is where it hit me in my heart, was that no matter how slight the harm, once there's a social breach, then the clock starts running on whether or not anybody can even come into court. And those people that are truly the bedrock of this state, hardworking, non-litigious, pick yourself up off the ground, get back on the horse that threw you kind of people, are told they can't come into court. People they want to sue, people that are suit happy, this statute and this court's construction of this law, I don't think it's going to have any effect on those type of people, or the, because those type of people are rushing to the courthouse anyway, these people, these
theoretical
people. Yes, sir.
I don't really understand your point to be that this was not slight, I mean, or this was less than slight harm. It seems to me your point really is that the patient here, the injured person, should be subjected to the statute of limitations only if they knew or should have known what the actual injury was, as opposed to just having some injury. It seems to me that's your point.
Excellent way to say it, Your Honor.
And if
yes,
if that's your point, how could the spirit of the statute that says time's going to run when this treatment ends, because the victim could always say, well, I knew I had blood in my urine, but I just didn't know it was cancer. I thought it was something else. Couldn't the plaintiff always say, I didn't know that that was the reason I was injured, and avoid the statute of limitations? How do we craft your kind of exception to make it still be a viable statute of limitations?
I follow the question. First, I don't think there's any way in the world that this court can craft any kind of law that prevents people with no conscience, with no sense of integrity, from lying. And I think that's the first part of your question is how are we going to keep people from saying something's true when it's not? And I don't know of any way in the world that you can do that. The second part, to answer it, is in a medical case, you've got all these medical records of what somebody told. What is the prognosis? Is this the steps when somebody goes into the hospital and has a problem? You know, it's a problem. They're hospitalized. How does somebody know that, well, this is now going to go into cancer? If they are required to sue, if Mr. Westfall was required to sue for his cancer that he didn't have back in 1986, you follow me so far, last treatment, let's say 84, and the open courts provision, we won't talk about that because we're talking slight injury, but he has notice of harm. If he was required to sue in 1986, then the way the law is that he has to come in, get his medical experts, and everybody gets to do that scientific mumbo-jumbo that looks into the future. Well, he might get it, he might not. You have that kind of trial, and you probably have those all over the state now about what's going to happen in the future, what's going to happen. This is, if someone is allowed to come in after it's happened, after it has manifested itself, when I say it, the injury has manifested itself into the type of injury that people rightfully should become very serious about, then you just have to look at the medical literature, you look at the result. I submit that for those of us who try the cases, we don't, and those of you who review the cases, we don't have to talk about this, we don't have to fortune tell. We can look back, we can talk about what happened, not what might happen. I hope that answered your question.
The cancer was diagnosed for the first time in 1991?
Yes, sir, within 2 years of the lawsuit, and Mr. Westfall died before the two years for him would have passed. That's just the way it happened.
Let me ask you a medical question.
Sir.
Is Hodgkin's disease a form of cancer?
I will tell you that I think it is from this lawyer's standpoint. I do not know that answer.
If it is a form of cancer, would that undermine your position to some extent by perhaps the argument that this gentleman already had cancer in a way that would be unrelated to the drug that he took? To make that cancer go away?
It certainly could if the court is going to talk about a type of disease as opposed to the stage of the disease. I know in this case that what we're talking about is a very complicated process once you look at it. I unashamedly and unabashedly admit that. On how do you keep everybody from how do you do it? I do not know. I know that death. I know that once somebody tells you you've got you're probably going to die in 18 months, that's pretty serious. And that to be told that you slept on your rights because 6 or 8 years earlier you found out you had urinary bleeding. I'm just here to tell you of the true, practical, harsh results that has on good people. It, as I talk to my son about it, as I tell him what the law is in Texas, I'm often telling him don't make mountains out of molehills. The way that I believe the law is being argued, and maybe perhaps the way the law is that one, there's no such thing as a molehill when you have an injury. If it's a legal injury, it is a mountain. And people, if they're not allowed to wait until you actually have a mountain, then everything's a molehill. Every molehill is a mountain. And people should rush to the courthouse instead of holding back. Those are my thoughts, and I don't need to waste any more time on the case. I've given you my thoughts.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
I realized as I was sitting down that the court is grappling with this question of, well, what degree of injury needs to be known back in 1984? And I'd respectfully submit, and I did a very poor job answering that earlier, but it's absolutely irrelevant. Under all of the decisions of this court, you don't do an open courts analysis in a wrongful death case. You don't even get that far. You don't get to the gut-wrenching issues that you guys are dealing with. And you reaffirmed that most recently in Baptist Hospital versus Arredondo. You reaffirmed it in Bala versus Maxwell, Moreno versus Sterling, Russell versus Ingersoll Rand also. I think, I'm not sure about Russell. But I guess what I'm saying is that in all of those cases, the court says, first of all, Morrison versus Chan says the only thing that's left of the discovery rule is when the statute's unconstitutional under the open courts provision. The first stage in open courts provision is, well, is there a common law cause of action? The answer in all these cases that this court and other courts, lower courts, including the corporate court, has offered is there's no common law cause of action because the wrongful death and survival actions are statutorily based. And so you can never have an open courts challenge. These issues of, well, you know, should he have noticed, is this a slight injury or whatever, only becomes relevant if you're conducting an open courts analysis, and that's improper on your argument.
Your argument is limitations would bar the claim 2 years after the treatment concluded, regardless of when the illness, the cancer, manifested itself.
That's true in light of the fact that we're talking about wrongful death and survival actions. If we were talking, and for purposes of distinguishing, in Lucas, this court held unconstitutional the damage cap under 4590I, and yet in Rose versus Doctors Hospital, in a wrongful death context, this court held that the damage cap was constitutional. It's a perfect analogy. This is the Rose versus Doctors Hospital part of your Wiener versus Wasson ruling. In Wiener versus Wasson, you wrote it, you know, that it was concluded that that the statute of limitations under Section 10.01 of Article 4590I was unconstitutional insofar as it purported to cut off a minor's cause of action. That was a direct claim. The kid had been operated on when he was 15 and he brought suit when he was 19. The court held that the 2-year statute of limitations was unconstitutional in that context. That wasn't a death case. In a death context, you go back to not being able to do that open courts analysis, and you wind up where you did in Rose versus Doctors Hospital. And I think it's a perfect parallel between Lucas and Rose and this case and Wiener versus Wasson.
But isn't the analysis whether or not the deceased had a viable cause of action at the time of his death?
Yes, sir.
And to determine that, don't we have to go through the open courts analysis?
Not according to this court's opinions in Arredondo and Bala and Moreno, and there's one other one, but I can't remember. But under all those causes of action, the court says that as to the wrongful death cause of action, you don't do an open courts analysis. And that's an error that I think both the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion made. They went into this discovery rule or open courts analysis when there was no basis for doing so in a wrongful death act.
Is this cancer, assuming to get into the discovery rule analysis, is the cancer that he had inherently undiscoverable and objectively verifiable within the meaning of our recent decisions on limitations case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand.
Well, we've recently held in discovery cases that if the injury is inherently undiscoverable and objectively verifiable, then the discovery rule may apply. Is this cancer, does it fall in that category?
I guess I'm not sure the opinion the court is referring to, which is why it makes
Altai
it difficult.
Altai and SD versus RV.
I'm sorry?
Alpi Computers and SV versus RV.
Boy, do I feel stupid, because I don't know the feelings, but the injury here was verifiable at the time that it occurred. I mean, there was nothing including Michael Westfall from making inquiry at the time of his initial injury as to what the other damages from overprescription of cytoxin were.
Was there any evidence that he could have discovered the cancer within the limitations, the 2-year limitations after treatment?
That would require expert testimony. There's been none, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Maybe it's a variation of Judge Owen's question, but I just want to make sure. Are you saying in 1984, when he was hospitalized for bladder problems, that he had bladder cancer then?
No, I'm not saying that.
Are you saying that's irrelevant?
It is irrelevant whether or not he had the cancer then or what the disease progressed into. If he had some damage, then applying the discovery rule, which I don't even think this court should be applying in the wrongful death context, there is adequate basis to conclude that triggers the statute of limitations. Going back to this court,
assuming we disagree with just for purposes of my question and say that he could not have known of his claim that cytoxin caused his cancer until 1991, would his claim still be barred?
The claim would be barred based on the damage that he incurred in 1984. And I'm not sure whether I'm not assuming away what I should be assuming away, or what you asked me.
Well, I'm asking if his claim is I got cancer from taking cytoxin, or his heirs are saying he died because their father, their husband, died from taking cytoxin because it caused cancer. He couldn't. What would he have sued for? Let me ask it that way. In 1984.
Well, what he would have sued for is the overprescription of cytoxin, which is his allegation in this claim, and the damages it caused.
Blood and urine.
Well, he would have gotten a doctor to testify as to his past damages and future damages, including the possibility of cancer.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second call. The court will take another brief recess.